And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Mises is right about America being a land of opportunity. And maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Hello, welcome. This is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Plath, as I go through the continuation of last week's topic of organizing, worker organizing, and different ways of doing so in the 21st century. How is it being done? How could it be done? What are the possibilities? And what are the issues with horizontal organizing? Having those horizontal, flatter organizations that are probably more trustworthy, more compatible with the values of everyone under the age of 40, the democracy and empowerment that we are all craving, that do not alienate us, so on and so on. This program, the Three Left Show program, covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective, for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. A left that is of itself and for itself. The meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. We proudly wave the flags of the three lefts. So the first topic I'm going on with is the organizing around issues that impact us. You know, what do we organize around? What gets people's interest? Of course, there are material needs. The things that affect their direct lives, and in particular in our economy, what affects their income, how kind of costs they incur, whether it be high rents, so you organize around tenants' rights, the ability to negotiate with landlords fairly in a tenants' union, or to put pressure legislatively to regulate landlords or regulate property, things like that. In particular, as I mentioned briefly, but I've cut out in the podcast version, I have paid off my student loan debt. It was not substantial, unlike many other of my peers, so I've kind of cut it down early. So I'm completely independent of that, and now I have a little boost to my income, which I will now put in various sectors like paying dues to various organizations. So I have a New Republic article, so pretty simple. Let's start with something that's pretty, you know, not too deep. The radical possibilities of not paying your student loans. A growing movement poses the question. We have the numbers, so what if we just stopped? Obviously, this falls under the purview of the debt strike. So just like rent strike, going on strike, withholding our labor, or withholding our dollars. Especially since so many are in involuntary strike mode by not being even able to pay these things. Now, where it gets serious is where, since the owner class or property owners, the owners of debt, the Wall Street firms, whatever they be, brokerages or what have you, or even the federal government, they need to keep collecting if things are to be stable. Of course, they're not stable because they are not able to collect, because we are not able, by we, not just workers, but the economy overall is not able to make enough value to pay back the debt that is created. See, the debt and other all kinds of debt are created with the assumption that double or more of the value will be created. But thanks to Marx's term, the declining rate of profit, there will always be a little less profit the longer you go in a capitalist system. The only way profit can ever increase is by expanding markets, expanding what can be exploited. So since, especially in this cycle of capitalism, meaning the last 40 years, we have run out of things to exploit. We've exploited time, we've exploited all kinds of various facets of our livelihoods, commercializing and financializing all kinds of things that were not before. What comes next? Colonizing space. Those are the next markets. I know otherwise. Let's move on with the organizing of the debt strike, which has been ongoing for a number of years now. In fact, debt strike as a moniker first came on my radar during Occupy and has existed throughout then. But otherwise, it's just been a general conversation of the problem, quote unquote, of student loan debt and just how that is a big bubble that is going to burst. Starting with the article written by Nick Martin. I left college $25,000 in debt. A fact I'm reminded of every month when an email from Great Lakes Borrower Services informs me that, quote, your automatic payment will be made soon. But relative to most American graduates, I got off easy. The average amount borrowed by an undergraduate in the most recent school year was $29,000. And the national debt burden comes in at a staggering $1.5 or $1.6 trillion, a number that feels impossible to fathom on its own. It's higher than the nationwide total of credit card debt or car loans, and second only to mortgages. Now, to put myself in context, because I am transparent, my student loan debt when I started was roughly $15,000, very low compared to the median. And thus, I was able to pay it within 10 years. For the millions of former students struggling to make their monthly payments, debt was sold to us as the cost of a better life. And its repayment, we will later learn, was the cost of any kind of life at all. I don't even really read the emails from my creditors anymore, since I know that the money is scheduled to come straight out of my account. My debt feels permanent in this way, unmovable. But what if it actually wasn't? What if we, along with millions of others, just stopped paying? The Debt Collective, part of a debt cancellation movement born out of Occupy Wall Street, wants you to at least consider the possibility. Quoting, the power of ordinary people in the grassroots is something that I just think is undeniable, says Ann Larson, one of the co-founders of that collective, speaking to the New Republic. What else could be achieved if we worked together and collectivized? That's really, to me, the lesson here, that big things can happen. The collective is using the scale of the problem to build a massive debtors union that can take on the interconnected systems of obligation that define the average American's finances. And what started as a fringe movement has since reframed the student debt crisis as we understand it today. As Astra Taylor, another co-founder of that collective, wrote for The Garden last year, the protests that grew out of Occupy over almost a decade ago represented a watershed moment, the point where student debt went from being a personal problem to a political one, the result of decades of disinvestment in public colleges and universities that turned education to a consumer product instead of a public good. That is what I mean by financialization, turning everything into a personal consumer product, even though they are impossible to actually fund or create without being a public good, whether by tax dollars or by communities, some type of community spending. In the years since, the activists, academic, and debtors behind the movement have won millions of dollars of debt cancellation through buying up debt on the secondary market and targeted debt strikes. Meaning targeting, so the only kind of, the debt striking so far has been limited, and maybe we'll go into this, of targeting specific lenders who are pretty much breaking the law in their collecting processes. Or somewhere in the process of being creditors, they've broken the law, so you strike to bring awareness and to basically, instead of paying them, you pay lawyers to sue them and thus waive the debt entirely. So those are specific examples where the organizing has been targeted and effective. On Friday, taking its movement into the new decade, the Debt Collective will launch a nationwide student debt strike. So far, 250 have signed on. Pretty low number comparatively, but this is why I'm talking about it, to encourage everyone else to sign on, with the hope of politicizing the millions of Americans, more than half of all borrowers, who are currently not paying their student loans, as well as encouraging others to stand in solidarity and demand the slate be wiped clean. So even though I paid off my debt, I can sign on as a supporter, so which I will need to do that. We are already a collectivity. We just haven't seen one another yet, Hannah Apple, another co-founder of the collective, told me, referring to the nearly 45 million people who have their student debt in common. And we haven't understood ourselves as a collectivity with an enormous amount of power. Come Friday, the Debt Collective hopes we can finally see each other. See each other. That's a nice sentiment. The state should not, quote, subsidize intellectual curiosity, Ronald Reagan told reporters in 1967, back when he was just the governor of California. At the time he took office, California had one of the most pristine public university systems in the nation. But Reagan saw the universities as fertile ground for budget cuts and a happy target in the culture war he was raging. It was a two-bird scenario for the budgeting conservative lawmaker. Attacking the public system would not only solidify his legacy as a budget hawk, but would directly drain the main source of income and professional growth for both his academic and working-class detractors. He would bring this same model to the presidency. As Devin Fergus, a senior fellow at Demos and professor of African American and African Studies at Ohio State, wrote in a piece tracing this history for the Washington Post, federal spending on higher education, quote, was slashed by some 25% between 1980 and 85. Just the beginning. And the Reagan administration shifted the federal government's focus from providing student higher education grants to loans. This sentiment, that the government should not be in the business of underwriting the pursuit of higher education, was steadily adopted by the entire nation in the decades since. So the Overton window was shifted. It became not only acceptable, but expected that education is something that you invest in yourself, not that the society invests in you. And if the society doesn't invest in you, why the hell would you feel obligated to invest in it? And thus, well, why don't people care anymore? Why are people just littering? These things, this is trickle-down culture war, you know? Why are us young people so intolerant? Why don't we respect civil discourse? You know, why are we making the discourse so toxic, writes liberals? Well, you didn't really fight very hard for higher education. You complained, but you didn't have any power. You didn't organize because there just wasn't good. To put myself in the shoes of someone from an activist 30, 40 years ago, especially in the 80s, you know, I'm definitely aware of the type of the negativity that was swirling around. You know, after 1980 and Reagan's, you know, victory, electorally anyway, it just became a victory in every other way. Why? Because it was in 79 that the courts ruled, pretty much lifted the cap that was in place for personal or individual political contributions. So this flooded the political system with private money. So it was in, you know, 1980 roughly, that there was in fact this entire shift in how our politics works, becoming something that where you cannot have wield political power without some collective fundraising happening. And then it could shift to individuals, executives, board members, and then eventually raising the cap on corporations themselves. By 2011, then you have the Citizens United decision, or maybe it was 2010 or 2009, Citizens United, which then lifted any kind of cap for if it's a third party. And by third party, I mean the super PACs. What's most remarkable about the student debt crisis is how quickly America normalized it, even as the numbers ballooned. You know, it's a slow, silent problem when it's market-based, because it's individual by individual. It's up to individuals to find out about a problem and then feel like it's just their problem. As The Atlantic reported in 2011, during the first quarter of 99, just $90 billion in student loans were outstanding. But by late 2011, that balance had ballooned to $550 billion. By 2016, the number had reached $1.3 trillion, with delinquency disproportionately impacting Black and Latinx students. All told, in 2017, more recently, the average American household had 828% more student debt than in 1999. So this was a result of us quote-unquote millennials going to college, that kind of age cohort. But see, by the time we go to college, then it's almost entirely privatized. By privatized, I mean the paying for it. None of it was public spending, except for Pell Grants, the poorest students, you know, the exceptions. You know, when I was growing up in the 90s, it was almost kind of sold, the culture was, the scholarship was the primary way of getting to college without being rich. You need a scholarship. And even as a preteen or a teen, I could just kind of see that the number of scholarships were not adequate. I mean, compared to the actual class, the senior class of, let's say, a few hundred students, 500 students, and then the number of scholarships that were available were a micro fraction of that, whether they be sports related, academic. Unless you're completely overachieving as a student, you're not getting these scholarships. That's how I thought. That's how I saw it. So I didn't expect any kind of scholarship. I didn't get one. I didn't work towards one because it seemed hopeless. And that's what it is. It's hopeless to rely on scholarship and grant programs. I kind of scurf when you have, say, a politician, local one, mind you, saying that they will take their salary and put it towards paying for someone in the community's college, create a scholarship program for 5 kids. Now, out of a neighborhood of 6,000, it's a drop in the bucket. It's always a drop in the bucket. But that's market solutions for you, leaving it up to charities and foundations and this, like, that's how we'll cover it. I mean, that's how education was kind of covered with before charter school systems were in place. You had religious schools that well-funded Catholic dioceses because of tithing and such, and a very large base to draw upon. They provided a lot of the local education for minorities because the public education system was just terrible and underfunded because it was parochial, entirely parochial. You know, the religious education system was the education system. The public schools were for everyone else, you know, Jews and poor kids. At least that's how it was here in Albany. And then it shifted to charter schools, which is why the charter schools look like Catholic schools, because the Catholic schools shut down or were completely defunded. I wonder why, what happened in the 90s and aughts that did that. Oh, yes. I'll leave that to you to figure out. Back to the article. The warning signs were all there. Stagnating wages, skyrocketing university tuition, and cuts to state funding, imbalanced increases in average cost of living, and a burst in for-profit colleges. But rather than become curious about young people's spiraling debt, the older generations, meaning the ones sitting in Congress, the ones on university boards, and behind the desk on the nightly news, sneered when the initial complaints were raised. After all, they had paid their way, gotten their degrees, and stepped happily into the workforce. Why were millennials struggling so much to follow in their footsteps? And so the following line rapidly became embedded in the minds of teenagers across the nation. If you want a better life, a chance at climbing the ladder, then you have no choice but to bite the bullet and sign on the dotted line. The system has been deeply broken, or actually functioning as Reagan intended, for decades. Yet it is only recently that the astronomical rise in student debt is beginning to be treated by establishment political and media figures as a nationwide financial crisis that it is. The issue has become a core part of Democratic presidential platforms. I have to pause for a second there, and this is the way the New Republic talks about these things. Like, it has it? I mean, I was paying attention to the Democratic debates, and student debt was, well, it was obviously a major part of Bernie Sanders' platform, and maybe the other candidates were following him and saying, oh, some college, some free college. But no, it's not full. It's not fixing the problem. And there's no discussion of absolving past student debt. It's usually about paying it forward to the next generation, which I'm totally fine with, but our ballooning debt is holding us back. But this new awareness did not just spring into existence. It wasn't just the debt collective building this movement either. This work has long been sustained by those inside the system, both as students and as professors and administrators. Could have fooled me, but he was an example of that. Tressie McMillan Cottenham an associate professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, worked in enrollment for two not-for-profit colleges before quitting over what she described as discriminatingly targeting practices by the schools. She told NPR that her wake-up call came when she saw relatively poor and low-income students deciding to take on both federal student loan debt and private student loan debt and inviting in their family members to co-sign on additional loans. It took years of public work by people like Cottam and organizing by grassroots operations like the Debt Collective, Strike Debt, and a collective adjacent Rolling Jubilee to get average Americans to a place where they understood their debt as political, a shift to when people finally got fed up seeing the notification of payment emails stack up in their inboxes, collectively fumed, enough with this. Now, a complaint that I've usually found it hard to describe in brief terms what my problem is with the inside-out strategy of, as they put it, let's see, sustained by those inside the system. I do not find any of these struggles sustained by people on the inside because it seemed like this person, you know, this McCotton person, she quit on her own. Did she organize a walkout? Did she organize people inside the institution? I would find that would be extremely difficult to do, or at least a lot of impediments to that. And that's the kind of things that happen when you're inside the system. In fact, it seems like her major step was leaving the system, meaning the for-profit colleges. Then she could act politically. Then she could act as someone who's free. Okay, the Debt Collective's end goal is fairly simple. White out all student debt. Simple enough, right? But there is a larger purpose on this path to dissolving the trillion-dollar debt albatross. The debt strike is about building collective power and making the millions of indebted Americans feel less alone in their struggles against it. Just under half of those with student loans are already not making their payments. Yeah. And many others are fed up with the monthly withdrawals that hardly make a dent in their principal, often paying off just the accrued interest. The Debt Collective is seeking people to stand in solidarity with the 250 strikers already politicizing their lack of payment. And they have a blueprint for how they think the strike can work because it's already worked before. So I think it's a particularly low risk to anyone listening that if you are not able to make your payments now, that you are definitely belong in this debt strike. You're already on strike, practically speaking, but now is time, as it always was, to join with others to say, this is not my problem. This is our problem. This is the country's problem. And something needs to be done about it, particularly absolving the debt. Caribbean Colleges was a company that owned a slew of for-profit higher education institutions. While it successfully marketed itself to over 100,000 students as a reasonable alternative to state schools, under the surface it was slimy, parasitic, and wholly emblematic of what the college system had become in the 21st century. As Reveal reported in 2016, at the peak of its power in 2010, Corinthian Colleges had more than 110,000 students, 105 campuses, revenue of $1.7 billion, most of it in federal funds. So, complete parasites on the public tit, as well as then personal loans and things. Navin Horns was one of the students that Corinthian took advantage of in the United States and Canada. In an email to the New Republic, he wrote that he had no knowledge of credit or loans when he enrolled because prior to that, he used cash for everything. So when the word loan came up, I had no clue of what would even mean. He explained, I have to press that the people in financial aid are trained to make sure that they word things in a certain way as to not alert prospective students. In 2015, and that's the way a lot of our economy works, not actually providing all information to the quote-unquote consumer. Too much work. The strike came amid a series of lawsuits filed against Corinthian by the states of California and Massachusetts, and it gives the lawsuits a bit of a political weight. And it provided a beacon for the thousands of others who had been similarly preyed upon. In concert with these efforts, the strikers ultimately secured $480 million in debt relief. Amy Schreider attended the Illinois Institute of Art, also a for-profit art school that was recently shut down by its new owners due to accreditation issues, meaning their curriculum sucked, and they weren't even providing good classes. The school left Schneider over $120,000 in debt, But the apathetic climate around student debt when she graduated in 2010 left her few prospects for finding justice. By 2015, Schneider had been in an online group for a few years with fellow students from her college who were trying to organize and fight back against the scheme. Quote, "We didn't know what to do with that energy." Then someone in her group dropped a link to the work of the Debt Collective and the Corinthian 15. When Schneider connected with Larson and the Corinthian 15, or 15 people that I assume are, yes, Horns and 14 other Corinthian victims that sued then those colleges. When Schneider connected with Larson and the Debt Collective to share the stories of her fellow indebted classmates, the massive scope of the issue started to come into focus for her. At that point, because I had been reaching out to my senators and everything, I'm feeling like completely alone with it, of course. And that's why I also roll my eyes whenever there's any call to contact your representatives or senators. Yeah, I mean, their job is to tell you to contact, like the people who say, do this, you know, contact your representatives. I mean, their job, and they're usually paid, they're part of the class that's paid as media professionals. They probably never called the representative before. If they do, I don't know if they get a personal response because they're in the press or something, but otherwise you get an automated letter just telling you to not worry about it, or we're working on it. You just get some bull crap. I've left many messages for my representatives. They don't make a difference. Not just because I'm doing it individually. I'm doing it as part of a rolling action to call representatives or senators. But does it seem to... No, and it does not make a lick of difference in the legislative process. This has been studied by Princeton. It was several years ago now, a few good years ago, that mass action, rather the, you know, when it comes to the political process of legislating, money is everything. Money determined what was in the law, what is legislation like, and you can see that in every piece of political action that Congress takes. And that's why I'm very comfortable with saying that all of Congress just needs to resign, and we need a completely new Congress with a new constitution that keeps money out of politics and actually guarantees a fair representation, because it's not going to happen without a complete overhaul. Back to the article. All of them are having the same financial issues with graduates, Schneider told me, some of them more than others. But there's a systemic failure from the current path where we have taken education from being a public good to a personal liability. As always, capitalism and liberalism together have attempted to offer solutions to the debt crisis that are actually just keeping the beast fed. Companies hiring fresh out-of-school workers have shifted their benefits packages, tailoring them to the crisis by offering to pay off student loans in lieu of higher salaries or better healthcare packages. It's a shell game. For those with these loans, the cup never reveals more money, only another bill. But the once fringe solutions pushed by the Debt Collective and others have steadily transformed into the mainstream approach. In the 2020 race, Dem candidates, Sanders and Warren, both introduced plans and legislation to forgive various amounts of student debt. The difference in the two candidates' approach come down to the age-old question, to means test or not to means test. Universal programs are always better. Warren's plan would go around Congress by pulling the levers of Higher Education Act, which allows for the secretary, you know, and I don't care about that. Because what does it matter? It's not going to pass the Senate, as you know, as I'm told by us fringe political third-party people. Oh, what are you going to be able to pass? You're not going to be able to do anything. But this is where striking is political power, because it means, but it tells those in power that they're not going to get what they want, and so it's really not up to them anymore. We are taking control, and that's not unfair. It's always framed that the abuse that we suffer from the system is what's fair. And when minorities, the marginalized, or just plain anybody who's gotten the short stick, when they respond, when they take matters into their own hands, whether they respond negatively or whatever, that's seen as unfair. Most blatantly, when corporations complain when, say, we do things for ourselves and we don't rely on them for our goods and services, that... you know, we're costing them money. True entitlement. And the same goes politically, that those who wield political power now, who have social power, social capital, who are listened to, they're entitled to be listened to. And as soon as they stop being listened to, stop having authority, cultural or otherwise, they say, oh, the discussion is not being is being subverted, is being toxic now. This cancel culture is ruining the discourse, when really all it is people refusing to be bullied anymore and acting as a group to not be bullied, because that is what it takes. That is the way I see it. So I will never complain about cancel culture, not in a serious way. But my Facebook friend that I met through working with the station here has laid out a pretty good response to the liberals' letter, open letter, about cancel culture, trying to draw attention to toxic discourse from the young people. And he says, what is your alternative? What do you propose instead? Because what you propose has been is the status quo, which includes the abuse that the marginalized have accepted or been exposed to all of these decades. It's always just been in the margins, invisible, not at the forefront. Now it is. Now it has been. And this is apparently unfair. This is a social crime. This is toxic. No, sir. But what is the solution? What is the alternative to toxic, overbearing, going too far cancel culture? The excitement of talking about disarming or abolishing the police. Let's not get carried away here. Let's not become the French Revolution. What's your alternative? The status quo? The same civil discourse you've been doing your whole 50-year career that has delivered us into the status quo that we are currently suffering under, destroying the planet? So I've gotten a totally different rant. I'm about done with this article. This is a model that's proved successful so far. When asked about the conflicting emotions that are stirred by the Debt Collective's daily work, seeing such a fast adoption of its policy proposals and simultaneously realizing the full scope of the issue, Apple cited a line from the recent speech she heard by abolitionist and renowned prison scholar Ruth Wilson Gilmore. We're here to acknowledge victory, and we're here to organize for the day after victory. So, something that's brought up in discussions of organizing all the time, I hear a few themes that come out, which are that it's building relationships and trust, and that's just starting with simple conversations. So then there are the barriers of being able to talk about workplace or social issues like one's debt, to talk about one's personal problems, and particularly to not see it as a personal problem anymore. Maybe it's this other person's problem. Maybe this is a problem or an issue across my workplace, across my the institution that I'm in, whatever it is. So here's a story from Medium. I think it's published directly from Amazonians United, which is about their victory for all Amazon workers. So Amazon, as a company, very anti-union, like every other big corporation, or even, hell, any firm whatsoever, from the established nonprofits to small businesses, everyone, every owner of any type or any management is anti-union, even the ones that are like stand for unions, which I'll link to the article, I'll find it again, but it was about how the Southern Poverty Law Center, right, the last institution you would expect, was also has a unionization drive for their employees, and the management is to deal with the union or to negotiate whatever they negotiate. They're bringing on a firm that, by their website's language, is about subverting unionization or dealing with it in a way that minimizes their impact. Why not deal with it fairly on equal terms? Or rather, why are you hiring these slick lawyers to act in your stead instead of simply acting in good faith? But what's usually missing about conversations about unionizing or organizing is the how, the gritty details, because usually it changes different place by place, and everyone has a personal experience doing it, so I can understand why they leave those details out. Sometimes they're just not useful. But I would like to hear these stories so I can have, and we can all have, a general sense of how we can do it ourselves. And it's especially hard when you're an introverted type like myself. You're not comfortable. And just also breaking through the general malaise and culture of the personal, seeing everything as the personal, but also in the type of workplaces that where everything is expected to be temporary. Like when you're a part-time worker with 100 other part-time workers, and that you're just doing this job until you can get something else. But then it just becomes everybody trying to get somewhere else that's better, rat race, more of the same bullcrap. So let's start with this read here. Big change begins somewhere. An idea, a few conversations, solid people coming together, a plan, and courage. We know y'all can make big change too because we, a small crew of Amazon workers at the DCH One Head in Chicago, just did our part to win paid time off for all Amazon workers. We heard that Sacramento Amazon workers started a petition for paid time off, PTO. We saw pictures of them bravely walking out, demanding a meeting with their regional manager. We decided that we had to take action too. We managed to get 251 co-workers to join us in signing our PTO petition. Three crews from three different shifts turned the petition in to our top boss at three mandatory all-hands meetings. More than half of our co-workers started wearing Amazonians United for PTO buttons at work. We went up against the wealthiest man in the world, and we won. We're growing our movement. This is just the beginning, and this is the story of how we've been winning. So in lack of a union, because unionization, especially on a corporation of such a large scale, there is a organization, a workers' org, called Amazonians United. So here is, why did we begin a campaign for PTO? Because we found out that Amazon was promising us vacation time and PTO on paper, but denying it to us in practice. Here's what we read, included in the owner's manual and guide to employment. So their employee manual, it's in there. Let's see. Vacation. Amazon believes that associates should earn and take vacation on a regular basis for their personal well-being, continued high performance. All regular associates working 20 or more hours per week accrue vacation during each pay period. Accrued vacation may be carried over from year to year up to 160 hours. Yada, yada. And the same with the personal time off. Amazon will provide all regular associates who are expected to work more than 20 hours per week with paid personal time and to be used in the event of illness or personal business. All regular associates who are expected to work 20 hours, doesn't say how much. When we asked our managers about this policy that wasn't being followed, they talked to us like we were stupid and couldn't read. They gave us all sorts of excuses saying, this policy doesn't apply to y'all because you're part-time workers. Despite the policy stating that associates who regularly work more than 20 hours, like us, get PTO. Then management claimed that we don't get it because we're Class Q employees, which we had never heard before. There's no law saying that bosses can't lie to you, you know. Or anyone, really. Whether it be advertisers, anyone doing business. Business comes first. Gotta keep that GDP growing. By any means necessary. Amazon was treating us as if we were inferior to all other Amazon workers, so we began talking to our co-workers about it. Many co-workers agreed that it's messed up, but just left it at that and didn't propose doing anything else about it. The constant hopelessness and apathy, but really alienation. But alienation is fought with solidarity. Some co-workers thought we were crazy and doing too much. Others would say things like, why are y'all always complaining? Be thankful you have a job. The normal, pure ideology. A number would say that they'd be with us if we did something about it. And the most solid co-workers agreed to meet up outside of work to figure out what we were going to do. We invited around 70 to meet up, and about 11 ended up showing up. Y'all might think, 11, that's it? Or you could say, hell, I probably can't even get two people to show up. Keep reading. We're going to give you some backstory on what we've done over the past year so you can understand how we're able to invite 70 and get 11 to show up. By the way, for an organizer, that's really good. That's where, like, getting two is eh, and like, well, at least nobody, you know, the worst thing is no one comes. Or nobody even takes you up on talking about these things. First, about where we work. It's called Amazon DCH1. If you're a Prime member in the Chicagoland area and you order stuff off Amazon, it most likely goes through us. We take care of the last mile of delivery. We scan and sort the packages, scan them into big, raggedy bags, load them into Amazon vans, yada yada. There's no union or nonprofit backing us up. It's just us workers, full of dignity, trying to make ends meet. Almost a year ago, in the summer of 2019, this is all recent, a small group of us got fed up with Amazon's bull and met up outside of work because we felt we had to do something. Amazon wasn't providing us with regular clean access to water. Either there was no water available, there were no cups, the water fountain didn't work, or the water was dirty. We had individually approached managers about this multiple times, and they would say, "We're fixing the situation." But they never did. So we decided to start a petition for our co-workers to sign demanding clean water. Now this is where actually, you know, so this is kind of step one. Organizing around the most basic of human needs. There's the horror stories of not providing actual bathroom breaks or bathrooms. And then water, actual water fountains. And that is, and that's where you can finally get people to go like, yeah, you're not asking for a lot, or hey, just be glad you have a job. That's maybe how you get around those kind of attitudes of like, yeah, we have a job and we're going to die doing it. This is what happened with the organizing around COVID for protective equipment and all the things I covered in previous episode. It's like your life has to be on the line before really kind of thinking that this is not just a personal problem. And that's strange, horrifying, sad, and seems to be the historical pattern. This is how organizing in the first labor movement was about. You know, people had to be dying, falling into the equipment, losing limbs, and nothing was done to fix it. Basic security, safety rules were kind of the first demands. You know, the Triangle Waste Shirt Factory is in the broad history textbooks. Co-workers were a little nervous, though, about signing this or any petition. But at the end of the day, a few of us managed to get 150 workers, co-workers, to sign this water petition. People signed because we weren't asking for something crazy. We were just asking for basic human necessity. Now, I think it's really sad that paid time off is considered crazy, or even the ability to take a day off and not be reprimanded or punished for it if you're sick, or if you have you actually want to take a doctor appointment or something like that. Within a few weeks of our initial meeting, we turned the petition in during our daily stand-up meeting at the beginning of our shift. We had one coworker raise their hand and say, "I have a safety tip. In fact, 150 of us have a safety tip here on this petition. We need water." Then our coworker spoke up too. The manager got all nervous, just kept repeating, "I'll take care of it right away." Within an hour, the manager had run to the nearest grocery store and gotten enough cases of bottled water for everyone. For the next month, Amazon had pallets of bottled water available to us. Within a few weeks, management had water lines and water stations installed throughout the facility. Because that's one of the ways to cut corners. Don't install plumbing. And the fact they had to buy cases of bottled water to provide it. But in getting 150 during the all-standing meeting to say, "We all want this at once," that's when bosses then start to stop beating around the bush. From this, we learn that we got the changes we need by getting organized and taking action together. Since there was still plenty of bullcrap to address, we met up again after some brainstorming, decided to name ourselves the DCH1 Amazonians United. We invited more coworkers who had signed the water petition to meet up at McDonald's after work. They decided that we do a survey to figure out what issues to address next. Survey results came in. Coworkers had spoken. "It's too hot. Our pay was too low. We need health insurance." So we collected signatures on another petition demanding AC, a raise, and health insurance. Then, during our 15-minute break on the first day of Prime Week, 2019, 25 of us marched into our boss's office. And this is the thing. Never march into an authority's office alone. Never go alone, ever. That's a general rule. Always bring someone with you. I believe it's your legal right to do so. You should never go to authority's office alone. I wish this was taught to us as students when you get called to the principal's office or something. Never happened to me, but it's always shown in media. You get in high school shows and whatever, get called to the principal's office. Wouldn't it be insanely cool if there was a plot around, like, the main characters going as a group. I think that's usually what happened in Saved by the Bell, where the principal seemed like such a non-threat, because the students were always kind of talking to him as a group, or Zach, Bella, or the main character Zach could stop time and had superpowers. That was probably part of it too. But in lieu of having superpowers, going to authority's office together, confronting any kind of bully or abuser, is definitely something you do not do alone. And the way unions work is that if you have union representation, if there were a union orientation, which there wasn't for, you know, in the union shop I worked at, grocery store, they would say that, you know, if HR ever wants to talk to you, you should always take shop steward with you. Okay. Oh yeah. So here's what happens when you actually confront the boss as a group. They make it personal. This is something all bullies do. Why are you attacking me? The manager got real nervous when they presented their demands to him, said that this was above his head and that he would get his top boss on it. As we were leaving his office, 5 minutes after break had ended, he cried out to us, "I just have one question for y'all. Why me?" Laughing, we told him it was his going away present because he was going to be leaving us soon. That same night, the site lead woke up early and rushed. See, and this is the thing that kind of how these hierarchies work, that the managers right above you are really nice. They really try to be as friendly as possible so that when they screw you, you don't feel like complaining about it. But when it comes to recognizing that there is a hierarchy, that no matter how nice the person above you treats you, at the end of the day, their purpose there is to manage you. And so no matter how nice and how it's not personal, right? Just as when they treat you like less of a human being, it's not personal, it's business. The same goes when you reverse the roles. It's not toxic. It's not you being overly demanding. It's what's fair. It's simply you or the underclass or the marginalized using power as well. And it's really interesting how that works. When people down the hierarchy, the lesser thans use power, it's injustice. No, that is what justice is. That is when we say no justice, no peace. That same night, the site lead woke up early and rushed to the plant to talk to his angry workers. But he started saying that he could only meet with us one-on-one, which we were not interested in. Clap, clap. He kept refusing to meet with us as a group, but on a real hot summer day, we succeeded in pressuring him to shut the warehouse down and send us home with our full shift's pay. The first time this happened at the plant since it opened in 2015. We continued taking action during these hot months. We confronted a disrespectful manager and made Amazon train them on how to treat us with respect. We confronted the top boss at our all-hands meeting, demanding a raise. We created these Amazonians United shirts and started wearing them at work. We started a weekly potluck during our lunchtime to share food and to build our own community. And of course, we kicked back and threw some parties on the weekends. Always got to have fun. All this to say, when we found out that Amazon was denying us paid time off, we were supposed to have, we were ready to do something about it. Build the groundwork. But it's the slow steps. It starts with the slow thing. And really, it starts with, and I like this story, because it starts with the most simplest thing of the petition. That, you know, it's very low risk to put a name on a list. Now, if there's an overbearing authority that you know will come for you in the middle of the night if you sign a particular petition, then there is risk involved. But that is part of getting over the fear that these people are willing to put out this petition and say that it's because it was such a thing like water. Like, they're going to punish you for asking for water, but the fear of punishment is what keeps everyone in line. And that's why a tackling and overhauling our punitive justice system is part of achieving any kind of justice in our society as any other kind of socialistic or whatever kind of thing, whether it be free college, forgiving student loan debt, et cetera, et cetera. So it starts with just the simple act of gathering signatures. And it's hit me because you had in my workplace of a shelter/building with 32 tenants, who are were homeless for a long period of time, and they're all alcoholics of one shade or another. But even one of them, he started a petition so that the tenants had access to cleaning supplies again. General practice was that we would have them available and cleaning supplies would keep disappearing. They weren't being shared or put back. So we just kind of had them in the office, and it was kind of by request, but also not freely available. So and you have to ask for something. You're not going to use it offhand or on a whim. And he kind of gathers petitions, and I was kind of rolling my eyes about it, like, you know, there's a reason that we don't have the cleaning supplies out for you guys. I mean, we had them out before, but they were abused. So it's not like this is more about making sure that we have enough cleaning supplies to actually use. Just like the hot sauce, problem with the hot sauce. But it's also the reverse goes, where the tenants ask us to keep the hot sauce in our office. And so that's on request so that the hot sauce doesn't keep disappearing. But anyway, he collected it and signatures, and I think half the tenants signed it. And it's like, fine, we'll try it again, because the petition's pretty much, we promise to return the cleaning supplies. And for the last month since we started doing it, putting them in the closets again, the closets that are open, you know, not locked, I think they haven't all disappeared. So, interesting. You might be wondering why part-time workers need paid time off. We'll break it down for y'all. At delivery stations, Amazon only hires workers for part-time jobs so that they can have a cheap and flexible workforce that they don't have to provide with health insurance or benefits. Well, this is the case with all of the underemployment of the workforce these days. I've lived it myself. And that's why I've kind of been working part-time. These are tough economic times, though. For many, one full-time job isn't enough to make ends meet. Many workers at DCH1 have multiple jobs and get very little sleep. Many of us have children, support other family members, and students. We need paid time off to recover from Amazon constantly grinding our body down and crushing our soul. In our capitalist economy designed to squeeze every last drop of energy from our bodies, we need PTO to have some time to breathe, live, and remember what it is to have dignity and freedom. So I am going to stop there. I've explained enough. Check out Amazonians United if you work for Amazon yourself, and particularly investigate the kind of needs in your workplace. Draw up a petition. Super easy. You know, low risk. Start with the low risk stuff so people can feel comfortable, and then you can start doing more and more.
Standing, we are all blindly believing that we must fight.
Welcome back to the Three Left Show. I am your host with the most, or the sort of mediocre-ish, Dan Platt, bringing you left-wing analysis from a radical left perspective. Not just the day's events, but on topics and issues that pertain our shared community-run future. Which leads me to finally circling back to the issue of a justice system that doesn't rely on toxic power and hierarchy. And I have two examples to talk about that. It also dovetails with the issue of having a baseline gate of entry for participating in said community projects that so many see as an injustice to impose, some type of tyranny. For example, in the Green Party National Convention, which, well, rather we call it the Presidential Nominating Convention, which is going to occur the day that you are hearing this, if you're listening on radio, is the, so I mentioned in the previous episode, Jesse Ventura supporters that basically wanted to participate. You know, they did participate. They're a pretty small group of youngish people. Who didn't know anything about our process, and thus, you know, there's kind of line one. Maybe before participating in an organization, you should learn their process. And since, unless that's not required, they're not going to. And then, and this goes for myself, you know, you join an org and you just have to, it's assumed you learn the ropes as you go. And this seems to be the case with any type of job. Job training is something that is only kind of there when it's something more professional or corporate, something standardized, which is a little alienating, maybe disempowering, but also better than just being thrown to the piranhas. So in the case of, like, say, you can vote in your state's primary in the Green Party by being a registered member. If you wanted to vote in one of the caucuses, because we also have caucuses, particularly the youth caucus, you need to be, in order to vote in that caucus, you need to be a dues-paying member. You need to pay, like, at least, I think it's like $5 a month to be a member of the youth caucus. And so there's a, you know, line there. And the, you know, Ventura supporters, as well as this happens in other areas as well, they see this as a poll tax. They call it a poll tax. But you see, this isn't like your right to vote on the national stage. This is an organization that is, in fact, private. And so, as an organization, we get to set the parameters for participation, as any private institution does. It's the public institutions that at least have the expectation of being completely open, inclusionary, and fair. Although, fairness is then something that depends on the situation. And the same goes maybe for, instead of money, it's time when it comes to actually participating in community projects, that in order to join a project that you should at least take the time to learn how things work. It seems like a kind of entitlement to just burst in and say or act like you're going to do things your way and not like any of the established ways that things work, right? Seems as uncouth, but it also seems to be something that is a pattern of people being entitled to doing things their own way. And if you try to impose some kind of rules on them, it's like, hey, you're tyranny, you're corrupt. It's really interesting how that works. So then to turn back around to the cancel culture, what would be the alternative to cancel culture? Mob justice, as it were. Well, obviously the alternative to mob justice is some type of justice system of courts and defense and, you know, and so on, the criminal justice system or the criminal injustice system, depending on who you ask. So pretty much we kind of need an alternative to both, or at the very least, a kind of social justice system. Ah, see what I did there? A kind of justice system that addresses social crimes or social harms that are done by quote-unquote offenders or by institutions. The ability to sue civilly, or to try to hold accountable using, quote-unquote, the law, right? But then we kind of need to set up our own kind of codes social codes, if you were, to codify the social rules that we communities, subcultures are laying down. So here are, you know, so there's two frames. So I'm gonna use two examples here to kind of discuss that. So first was a more official, well, definitely official one, a program of my county's DA's office, which was called the Community Accountability Board. It was the restorative justice program. I shouldn't use the past tense. It's still going on. It's simply my participation in it has ended. But in order to participate, right, anyone could sign up. It is a very simple, easy process to sign up. I don't even remember doing it. That's how fast it was. But what did take time was you sign up, and you're signing up for the orientation, which is a, I forget if it was a weekend, it was like 2 days, or it was just one long day. I think it was just one long day where I go to the police academy building where they got, you know, big break room there. And it was there that we did workshops to a, you know, PowerPoint presentation of what is restorative justice? How does it work? How does the CAB work? What kind of expectations do we have of you? So everyone's on the same page. It was a very low bar. It was just like a seminar, a few seminars, and we did some practice sessions of what we'd be doing. You know, just going through it once. So it was really basic, not a full, what I would consider a full training. That would come by participating, doing a bunch of these sessions, CAB sessions as they were, where you basically have an offender, someone who has committed something of a misdemeanor or less, and let's say shoplifting, and the judge, instead of going to jail or paying a large fine, or the judge assigning how much community service that person receives or has to do, which is all very uncontextual and not punishment fits the crime, and certainly doesn't have the person ability of being community led. In this case, it is all of those things. Where, you know, we meet with the offender, we go over, ask for their side of the story, give them a full hearing, they feel heard, they might be really, really uncomfortable. It's, of course, it always starts awkward because it is a completely new and different experience. It helps to have some elders, you know, some grandmas, sometimes some cops have signed up for it, and that's kind of why I left. Every meeting I was doing had, like, at least one cop there, you know, off duty, of course, but I mean, they do them, so they understand the offender's side, and they're usually the community officers that are, in fact, you know, they've done the de-escalation training, they don't want to be the bad cops. So, yay for them. But it was still kind of, they kind of had their conservative worldviews, and I'm going to take these people at the a bad faith value, you know, like why are these millennials dragging their feet, not getting the stuff done? I'm like, well, I can imagine what kind of impediments they have. I'm willing to give them an extension. They weren't. That's an aside. But it was generally good. In fact, as all restorative justice is, I basically did cover that in a previous episode as well with the peace circles and alternatives to policing episode. And this would be an alternative to, well, criminal justice system, because when we talk about police abolition, we also talk about court and prison abolition. You know, how to do that. And so CAB is a program that kind of represents that. We only did things up to a misdemeanor, but there is obvious experiments and others where you cover felonies, actual assaults, actual violence, how to resolve that, how to get both sides at the same table. Maybe they just test each other so much. In the mindset of punishment of they just need to go to jail, I don't want to see them again. But that is not justice, as that does not solve any actual social problems. You know, when you go out to for revenge, you must dig two graves, says First Nation proverb. The other example that would more pertain to the social justice system of an alternative to toxic mob-based accountability is something that I did with the local Food Not Bombs chapter, where over and over, you know, we set up a kind of space, safe space committee, you know, questions of how do we maintain our space, meaning where we serve the food as a safe space. Yes, that kind of safe space, mostly meaning a space where you are free from harassment. Or if someone does harass you, you can go to one of your volunteers, like me, servers, and actually report it and feel like something will be done about it. particularly, do we kick them out? What kind of standards do we have for kicking people out? Do we give people a second chance? We obviously want to do that. So we set up a process. We call it, it was an accountability process, which I found, at least, it's on paper, and we did it once, and I think it worked. It was viable. Okay. So what it made up was, someone reports some type of abuse, usually anonymously. They're embarrassed about it. They don't want to make it public. They don't want it to become some mob justice thing or whatever. Usually they just bow out and they never show up again. We don't want that to happen either. We want people to be able to feel safe, so on. So they report that, say, in the kitchen, in volunteering, a guy was being a creep, or say they were yelling, something like that, or they touched me, during the serving, something like that. And so we had an arm, basically volunteer, to investigate it, to ask both parties next time they show up to the dinner, to ask others for character references. Is this something that this person has done before? And so on, to actually investigate. So it isn't just, on just the accuser's word. Next step, confirming whatever happened or didn't happen. Then there would be a kind of talking to the offender or the person who was accused, and suggesting ways of mediating the harm, some type of restorative practice. So write an apology letter. Not just promise you won't do it again, but also acknowledge that what you did was wrong. And this usually means asking them, and because it's a voluntary organization and a voluntary dinner, of course, the punishment, or rather the restorative practice, is then entirely voluntary. And here's where it becomes a matter of voluntary, or then we do ban you. And that's what occurred in the case where we asked the guy to read some feminist lit and educate yourself on the harms of one, and maybe even figure out like what they did was wrong and have that realization. But many people are not willing to change and not willing to learn. So if not, then okay, yeah, then you're not welcome back in our space. But at least we gave you a chance. And that's a kind of, at least a, definitely a step higher than the mob justice and whatever passes for so-called cancel culture. What are you canceled from? Canceled from a space, job, what kind of punishment, And then it comes, and this is where the complaint comes in, that it's all punitive. Where is the restoration happening? Now, of course, when it comes to abusers or systemic societal abuse, creating safety and just making them stop becomes priority one, and justice and fairness doesn't really factor in. But as an alternative and something to go forward, these are the kind of things that maybe we could actually produce. Now, this was only viable for this Food Not Bombs chapter because A, we had a space that we were kind of in the authority of, and we kind of had control over the space, so to speak. So how does that work on a higher level, a local level, a national level? If it's a national figure that's been accused, does it have to all be settled in civil court? Does there have to be a criminal prosecution? Obviously, the dangers that liberals are pointing out is that people are being punished for things that are not criminal activity. They're just expressing their opinions. They're just using their free speech rights, even if it's causing material harm to others. And that's where the overlap and the stickiness, the fuzziness comes in. And thus we need fuzzy solutions of sorts that are not just vague suggestions of, civil discourse, respecting free speech rights. So with that established, now I can move on to the next kind of, not an organizing story, but what kind of organizations they take, what forms they take. In Food Not Bombs, we have a completely horizontal, consensus-based organization. And for a group of 10 people, that is okay. And here is an example in the business side of things of an actual firm that produces content, not just reappropriates garbage food to make community meals with, which is what Food Not Bombs does. Here's a story from Vice. In the video game industry, I'm a gamer, so this is sort of relevant to me, but also relevant to the forms of business and worker ownership and equity and so on, because this is about how a co-op of game developers is actually ditching that co-op model for quote-unquote capitalism. The game Dead Cells was made in an environment where workers shared equal power, equal pay, equal profits. That's not how things will work at their new studio that they are calling Evil Empire. So I think they're very much conscious of the shift that they're making. It's a very conscious one. But why are they making it? Well, this is filed by Patrick Kepek. And the title is The Ambitious Future of Dead Cells is Ditching Co-ops for Capitalism. Dead Cells entered Early Access more than 2 years ago and is still being updated with new weapons, enemies, areas. But this wasn't the plan. Dead Cells was not supposed to go on for years, but the massive success of Dead Cells caught developer Motion Twin, that's their firm name, by surprise. And so this past August, they made a big change. Dead Cells would live on, but no longer be developed by Motion Twin. Instead, the future of Dead Cells, particular game, and its updates, its sequels, whatever it is, would be handled by a new studio called Evil Empire. So it's more like a splitting off, not just the conversion of it. So I think Motion Twin is still going to be a co-op, but the as far as the continuation of a particular game and online content, because this is the kind of model where you put out kind of a game and you just keep adding to it, downloadable content that you know you charge for each edition, and so on. And you also just improve the game even with new stuff over time. So you know you don't have to pay for every new improvement to a game, but for good, you know, for more expansive improvements, that's what you do. It's not really a great model, but it's the model that has developed from the material conditions of the industry and everything else. So Evil Empire isn't a bunch of newbies, but made up of a handful of Motion Twin employees who wanted to continue working on Dead Cells while Motion Twin itself moved on. It's being led, so this is also a matter of the people at Motion Twin wanting to move on to a new project and not just keep making new content for the game. So you have some splitting off happening for that reason too. It's being led by Motion Twin's now former head of marketing, Steve Frilby. And despite being spun off from Motion Twin, it's still subject to their approval. Motion Twin weighs in on and signs off on their creative decisions when it comes to Dead Cells. So they still maintain some that creative control. Critically, though, Evil Empire is not something Motion Twin was and remains, a co-op. There's a lot of reasons for that, though the main one is directly related to scaling, said Frilby in a recent interview with me about Evil Empire's decision-making. While I am literally having heart palpitations thinking about all the work, the aim of the Evil Empire team has always been to grow and be able to grow past the 8 to 10 person limit of the Motion Twin model. A co-op pushes back on traditional corporate structures, in video game companies or otherwise, in which some are paid more than others, some have financial investment in the studio that could later pay off with a hit, or if the company is sold, and others not. In broad strokes, a co-op tries to flatten things and put everyone on the same playing field, including economically. The vast, vast majority of video game companies are not co-ops. It's a rare concept precisely because it runs counter to society's traditional understanding of power dynamics. Motion Twin was a successful developer before Dead Cells, a studio with a string of hit web games, but the brilliant action game mashing up Castlevania with roguelikes. Those are two terms that I would have to explain to non-gamers, but let's just put it as it is a 2D platformer where you unlock areas by getting new abilities. Making a hit game is hard, but not itself unique, but Motion Twin as a company definitely was. As profiled by Kotaku in 2018, Motion Twin was built as a co-op from the start, which meant all its 11 developers shared equal status and equal pay. Full equality! Onwards, comrades. We actually just use a super basic formula. If a project finds success, people are basically paid more in bonuses, and everyone is paid the absolute same way. This is their game designer, Sebastian Bernard, who told Kotaku at the time, and who still remains at Motion Twin. The devs and the artists are paid the same amount of money, and people like me, who have been here for 17 years, are paid the same amount as people who were recruited last year. Philby told me the co-op model came with specific challenges Evil Empire's hopes to address. Quoting him, and this is an important thing to understand about horizontal structures and co-ops. That's why I like this story. The co-op model comes with a bunch of constraints, he says. It's not all rainbows and fists in the air. There's a stack of work, emotional costs, and a whole lot more that's hidden below the surface. It's definitely not for the faint-hearted or someone looking for a cruisy 9-to-5. When you have to defend and justify your every idea to each and every member of the team, you have to be very motivated. Philby pointed towards the concept of permanent battles, where Motion Twin's zero hierarchy model, in which bosses are made irrelevant and everyone has a voice in a creative decision, regardless of their expertise, has as a game of persuasion, and this was really taxing. You pointed towards moments, without specifics, where parts of the team would be blindsided, when a decision that had once been a yes would become a no for uncertain reasons. Quote, it sucks when you have to give people a crash course in graphic design, especially when those people are programmers and capable of drawing a stick figure, says Philby. At Motion Twin, everyone can criticize everything everyone does, or anyone does, which leads to some bizarre moments. We're trying to centralize these moments with regular playtesting and dedicated feedback sessions instead of the perma-siege that can happen at Motion Twin. Despite this, he noted, none of the above are reasons not to make a co-op. Instead, Evil Empire is still looking towards the co-op model to establish its own organizational founding. Now, some of my own commentary on this, as a good Jewish scholar should. So permanent battles, in quotes, reminds me of the Trotskyist term permanent revolution, where you're always kind of always fighting the capitalists and never kind of coming to some accommodation with them. And that kind of has its drawbacks in the same way that this does. Now, how this is solved is that it sounds like, you know, these guys with really living their egalitarian values the best they can, God bless them for it. What they seem to be missing is that kind of consensus decision-making process that Food Not Bombs chapters and good Occupy groups and working groups, anarchist or otherwise, use. There is also a general educational nonprofit called Sociocracy, in which they're all about developing and educating on using consensus and horizontal structures in a way that doesn't turn into this permanent battle where one problem with the certain consensus models is the whole you don't do something unless everyone agrees with it. This is what creates the really taxing and emotionally laborious problems of having to convince everyone of your idea of the same exact idea, and everyone has to agree. That is not good consensus. Good consensus is more the framing of everyone being okay with an idea, willing to accept it, willing to live with it, right? Which sets the bar quite a bit lower than they all have to like it. It's like, well, I don't like it, but I don't hate it either. I can be neutral. It allows for neutrality and the ability to say, well, I am not an expert in this. I will defer to the authority of the expert, right? Which is what any anarchist good anarchist will tell you, smart one, about dealing with the pandemic. We will defer to the authority of the pandemic experts, the scientists, the doctors, so on, right? There is justifiable hierarchy, usually in experience and education, and especially when it comes to specific areas. Expertise, in fact, doesn't go away with anarchism or horizontal decision-making. The other principle that comes into play with consensus and participatory government is the fact that authority or decision-making power is proportional to one's stake in the decision, which in this case, everyone does have the same exact stake, which is why there was probably that impulse that everyone needs to be really invested in what everyone else is doing, whether or not they know anything about it, like art or, you know, the programming side, what have you. Let people have their areas of expertise and thus control and thus personal autonomy within the horizontal structure of all being autonomous. So let's see, the metaphor used for this is like you have a workplace, let's say with the 10 people, they all have their own desk, and you have control over your desk as far as things on your desk, things you see, like a picture. Your neighbor working next to you does not have any say or should not have any say in what kind of pictures you have on your desk. What they should have a say in is, are you if you're playing music and they can hear the music, meaning not using earpods or headphones, but if they can hear the music, then they should have a say in what music you're playing or whether or not you're playing music. That's the nitty-gritty metaphor. But some of the changes, so going back here about changes of evil empire. So they're not changing their mindset of egalitarian values here. They're not saying, well, it was hard, so we're going to be suits anyway. No, they're sticking to their values. Some of the changes are huge, though. Evil empire wants to get much bigger, and Philby argued it requires getting some of the structural elements like paying everyone the same. We reward talent and pay people who are extremely good at their jobs more, which makes it easier for us to recruit compared to Motion Twin, which when it is a group of 5 to 10 people, it can be a group of friends. And thus, you can all like, yes, we are all the same here. Once you get past 10 people, then stratification will happen. It will occur. Naturally, because of differences in skill, as mentioned here, and expertise. But if you value all expertise the same, like say the doctor's expertise should be valued the same way as a plumber's, they should be paid the same, so to speak, relatively. Let's see, more from Philby. Where you sometimes have awkward conversations with people. Yeah, your base salary will be a third of what you could get in London, but if we blow it out of the water, you'll be rolling in it. This can be a tough sell for seniors working with lots of professional experience, with families who need stability. It also means not every employee at Evil Empire has a guaranteed stake in the studio, a process Philby called selective. The plan going forward is a system where everyone who works on a project gets a cut, but the details haven't been fully worked out yet. Probably should be negotiated as the employees kind of form a collective, you know, union of themselves. Once everyone's hired and there, then the bonuses can then be developed over the course of their first year there, I suspect. Philby said it was cautious about making sure we've got enough reserves to build the next game post Dead Cells, just in case our collaboration with Motion Twin ends sooner than expected. Now that sounds ominous, like they're going to break off eventually. But maybe that last line seems to suggest the collaboration may not be permanent. In France, where Motion Twin is located, the studio is a SCOP, S-C-O-P, or Society Cooperative, a relatively recent phenomenon. There's no legal requirement to have a flat hierarchy or to share power. But what it does mean, by French law, Philby explained, that Motion Twin is legally required to pass on a specific percentage of its earnings to workers. And traditionally, Motion Twin has passed on most of its profits to workers, that group of 10 guys. The result is a studio that doesn't have a war chest, a surplus, an actual savings, in case things go awry. But its workers end up personally enriched. When Motion Twin makes money, said Philby, 95% becomes salaries and bonuses. The members of Motion Twin know they work better with a fire under their butts. Every rut they've ever had was caused by an abundance of comfort, so they like to live dangerously and to stay hungry. Which is fine for young 20-something guys, not so great for people with families, as mentioned. Because of the way Motion Twin is structured, it pays a lot of taxes for the awesomeness of the French welfare state, as Philby put it. That's all on purpose, but Evil Empire wants to be more conservative. A percentage of Evil Empire's eventual revenue will get paid out at certain milestones, with money given out based on post, seniority, and time with the company. It's in line with the way companies inside and outside of games distribute money. And unlike Motion Twin, Evil Empire will, in fact, have a war chest for the savings. People will run themselves into the ground if the team isn't vigilant, ensuring that crunch and burnout aren't kept under control. Now, I need to explain that the games industry is amazingly abusive to its workers, particularly in the form of crunch, where they force workers to, because they're under salaries, to work amazing, by amazing I mean incredible amounts of overtime to meet deadlines for games that then still come out half finished, because the publisher asks for a game to be published. You know, they want the game ready in a year. It's like, no, this is going to take 3 years. So they're going to end up doing years of work in a matter of months. And that is dangerous and thus leads to burnout, actual psychological breakdowns, depression, all kinds of bad stuff. It's incredibly abusive. And that's the kind of things that, as a co-op, they likely want to avoid, and they also want to avoid that by having a larger staff in the first place. But it's also stressful to not know where your next paycheck will come from. Additionally, Evil Empire has ambitions to be a much bigger company. Over the years, Motion Twin fluctuated in size, but eventually settled between 8 and 10 employees because it was a size the structure could handle. That number is in line with Canadian studio KOOP, which also has modeled themselves after a co-op for many years. So that's co-op with a K, but also KOOP. But having less than a dozen employees means that only so much work to go around, which means the scope of whatever game the team is going to design will also be limited. These are by design, of course. It would be challenging to keep equity among a large studio with dozens or hundreds of workers. By keeping teams small, it's more manageable to ensure the notion of equity remains in place. Limited scope is a successful byproduct. I think here I'll mention Mondragon Corporation, which is a co-op made of smaller co-ops. So you have workplaces of 10 or so people, and then you basically scale that up by basically having 100 different of these teams that are organized into these smaller firms that then make up the bigger firm that then manages savings for investment. But that's still like a kind of old-fashioned co-op. The kind of thing here of Motion Twin with their full, like, we actually distribute any surplus to the 10 employees is pretty cool, and I'm wondering how that could be arranged in a confederation of small 10-person businesses. That's the kind of economic planning that can occur, also known as a syndicate, you know, between unions. But unions are made up of many hundreds of workers or dozens. But a union could also just be an association of 10, whether it be a work crew in a particular area of a factory or something like that. Possibilities are endless. Whether these changes impact the kinds of games Evil Empires makes, for better or worse, remains to be seen. That said, it's a little ominous when said changes, a shift from worker equality to worker inequality, come under the guise of a studio calling itself Evil Empire. Quoting him, "We are conscious of the fact that we're competing with other organizations all over the world that have all kinds of comparative advantages, like, say, offshore tax havens or something like that. But we're also realistic about respecting ourselves." Also, the advantage of abusing your workers and whipping them to death. Yes, there's that too. This means that there are several core things that Motion Twin does as a co-op that we can reproduce in any company structure, which, while still remaining a company with, at the end of the day, a profit motive. So the ability to, or the necessity of profit motive is also kind of something that, if you're an anti-capitalist like me, comes into the picture when it comes to what will it take to make co-ops actually like just and sustainable long term, like to actually be able to scale up. So this story is an example of a co-op in order to do something bigger or even to maintain their current like hit smash, you know, product, they need to scale up and then they need to cast off a bit of the egalitarianism. That's not good. How do we resolve that? I think we resolve that by thinking bigger, right? Bigger meaning that, you know, that last phrase, profit motive, needs to be called in question, you know, forms of ownership. But as far as transitionary goes, having a policy like that social quality type of firm, where maybe you pay a little lower tax rate in return for actually paying your workers enough, or the workers enough, since it is one and the same, management workers. That's socialism of a type. Now they don't need to rely on government programs. Though, as far as France is concerned, they still get all of those programs. So that money that they get, that surplus that's distributed to them, then actually goes into their pocket and they're living their best lives. So to the same topic of like worker ownership, then kind of scaling up, here is an example, a historical one, from Planning Beyond Capitalism, which is simply a history of workers' councils, written by Barbara McLean, written in 2014. But this is just a simple explanation. So an explanation of what are workers' councils. Throughout the last 150 years, there have erupted a series of attempts to take over social life without capitalists, without the state or vanguard party leadership. These workers' councils arose out of irreparably critical situations in the existing order. In some situations, they emerged alongside the state, creating a dual government. For example, when the state fell during the Spanish Revolution or the Civil War, some workers' councils spread over a wider terrain, reaching as much as one-third of the country. In some cases, they not only governed without the state, but in places they abolished the local currency and began their own system of exchange. That would be a union-run economy. That's what that is, or a form it took. These experiments took place during a revolutionary process, one of disorder and so on, when the official authorities lost their power, but before state power was then regained, which is why they didn't last. The reorganization of this world and the experiences that participants had must have been beyond their wildest dreams. These movements lasted as a short time as 3 days with the Seattle General Strike, or as long as 3 years during the Spanish Civil War. Like most social movements, these councils began as simply reacting to the abuses of the existing order. Workers wanted higher wages, better working conditions, more justice. But once the authorities lost power, the workers found themselves doing far more than they bargained for. Though these workers' councils were inventive and festive, like all creative activity, they were productive and contained their own collective discipline. In Spain, after the failure of Franco's coup in 1936, over the following 3 years, at least one-third of the country was self-managed, resulting in better productive records than the overthrown government. This was done in the middle of a civil war. So it's particularly using Spanish Catalonia as an example. But it's a powerful one, because it was kind of the most total, where entire area of the country, as they say, a third of it, was actually governed by a council of unions. The internal organization of the councils expressed the collective creativity they were demonstrating in the world. They were organized in an anti-hierarchical, anti-bureaucratic manner. The workshop of the councils, the foundation from which all decisions were arrived at, was a general assembly. Whatever resolutions resulted were carried out by mandated delegates who had no independent power of their own, unlike current reps who, once elected, have power to make their own decisions. The delegates merely, and that's the difference between representative and delegate, for the record. The delegates merely carried out decisions already made in the assembly. Secondly, these delegates were often rotated so that no one got too comfortable or began becoming a more permanent authority. Lastly, the delegates were immediately revocable. This means that any abuses of power were grounds for immediate termination. So this is not just describing what happened in Spain in the 30s, but this is also describing how horizontal governance, when scaled up to a municipal level, occurs. So instead of elected reps, you have chosen delegates who then act in assemblies, or the assemblies choose the delegates, and the delegates carry out the decisions, or at least they manage the decisions, which is something else that I left out of that commentary about the 10-person firing squad of having to agree with everything. To not have any type of boss whatsoever. But instead, of course, using the boss, you have someone managing, or I like the word underlining, or just leading the effort. So the 10 people elect one person to lead, to kind of be either the manager, right? This is how pirate ships worked. You know, captains were elected by the crew. If the crews didn't like how the captain was running things, they would throw him overboard, or rather they would unelect him and choose a new captain. And it was only if they refused to step down, then they would be thrown overboard. But for the most part, it was all pretty democratic. And this is also how the Pirate Party in Germany and some other Scandinavian countries, it's a minor party over there, they elect delegates and have liquid democracy, as they call it. Not going to go into it, but they also see leadership as something that is temporary, something that's revocable by the membership, and that leaders are simply those that carry out, that make, how do they put it? They're the facilitators of the desires of the membership, whether it be a pirate crew or, in this case, a workplace. When you elect a leader, you're not electing them to be the boss, to tyrant over you. You're electing them to simply facilitate so that decision-making is smoothed over. And it's not a matter of everyone having to agree. As a facilitator in a meeting that I've done many, many times, it's all about finding consensus, designating someone to manage the discussion and figure out what everyone agrees on or where's the common ground. That's something that's kind of missing from these so-called civil discussions where we're supposed to find common ground, right? Which is like it's expected to have two people disagree, they're eventually find common ground. You kind of need a moderator that actively participates in the discussion, which is why I really don't like these most quote, so-called debates where you have a moderator who basically just poses a question and then steps back and lets the blood sport commence. Back to talking about workers' councils. In both the amazing coherence of their social management capabilities or capacities, as well as the profound change in the quality of their interactions, these experiments were truly out of this world. In fact, the depiction of what happened to the participant runs into the same problems that any mystic or artist or person who had a peak experience when they try to describe their experience. How do you describe an experience which seems almost as if it's on another plane of reality using the language of the existing order? You know, when you're actually free of hierarchy and bosses and authority, like how do you actually talk about it? The presence of worker self-management flies in the face of capitalist claims that workers are lazy and unproductive. Time and again, we have seen that when workers can't control what is produced, as well as how it is planned and executed, they produce more in less time than any other workers under capitalism. Here's some examples of when workers' councils occurred, this horizontal decision-making. Just a quick run-through. Paris Commune in 1871, St. Petersburg Soviet in 1905, which is kind of like the first first go of the Russian Revolution. There was one in 1905 before the one in 1917. And that's the next one, the Russian Revolution in 1917. Soviet is a workers' council, by the way, just so you know. Short-lived experiments in Poland, Italy, Germany, and Bulgaria in the interwar period. Or rather, 1917 to 1920, you know, in the few years after the end of the First World War, there was a time of much disorder, and there was a power vacuum because the authorities had completely lost all of their authority, viability, and legitimacy because of the killing fields of, which is something to consider about our own government, its legitimacy waning day after day, creates opportunities for such experiments, which is apparently what America is supposed to be good at, right? And that's where it's kind of the American experiment is full of these contradictions where, like, state experimentation is part of what makes the federal government legitimate, right? But when the experimentation, like, say, with how to handle a pandemic, then becomes our great weakness, that's when that federal system loses its legitimacy. Something to consider. There was the Spanish Civil War in 1736, Hungarian Revolution in 1956. There was a French general strike in 1968, and in Chile in the early 1970s. The viability of the councils as experimental forms is indicated by the fact that they have occurred over most parts of the world, 150 years behind them, and the overwhelming majority of participants had no knowledge of their occurrence in other places. Horizontal democracy just kind of happens when people are left without big authority, and they have to figure things out for their own, groups of 10 or more. Let me do my outro. First, my profound thanks for listening, an important skill as important as talking, so I plan to listen to any constructive feedback sent in, ideas for the show, or stories and topics you'd like to hear discussed, and also any references for possible guests. Capitalists and statists alike don't believe work like mine is worth paying a living wage, so you can support the show via its Patreon page. I also want to give a shout out to Jeremy Brand, my current patron. Capitalists and statists... You can also support the show for your time by telling others you believe would be interested about it, liking and sharing our Facebook and Twitter posts and pages, all found by searching 3 Left Show on those platforms. The last 10 episodes are broadcast on all or most podcasting apps, with a full archive, along with show notes for each episode, and info about myself, all found at 3lefts.news. Of course, the most important thing is to put the ideas, thinking, projects talked about here in practice. So thank you. Till next time, keep waving the flags of the 3 Lefts.